Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 101, I am joined by Dr. Michael Jumper of West Coast Retina. He describes his technique of external drainage during vitrectomy for repair of regmatogenous retinal detachments. And we cover other topics, including fellowship education. Good morning, Dr. Jumper. This is Jay Schreather. How are you?
Hey, Jay. Please call me Mike. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Michael Jumper. Dr. Jumper is a partner at West Coast Retina in San Francisco, California, and he's joining us today from the West Coast. Dr. Jumper, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jay.
So we usually start interviews with new guests by thinking of the residents and fellows who listen to the program and take some inspiration from the people who come on. So how did you decide first on ophthalmology and then retina? Was that something that you had kind of in mind when you went to medical school?
No, you know, I was the first person in my entire family to have gone to medical school, so I went in with a pretty open mind. I had an engineering undergraduate background, but really I feel like it ended up being kind of about the people that I was around. So when I was in medical school, I had a really fun time working with the residents at my medical school at a busy hospital, and we, you know, in a very short period of time, got to know the people, the ophthalmology residents, who were really nice to me, let me do a lot of things, and basically took it from there. I had a pretty short list by the time I was a third-year medical student of what I wanted to do, and it turned out that ophthalmology really fit me the best.
And then who were kind of the people who inspired you to go into retina?
Well, there were my mentors at UCSF were really the big inspiration, and that included four or five people that I think are kind of big names in the field. Somebody you may not know was Alex Irvine, who I think was arguably one of the best trainers of retina residents, because at the time I was at UCSF and there were no retina fellowship training program, and Alex really put all of his efforts into training residents in retina and teaching us as much as he knew in the field, and really was inspired by him. From the community in the practice that I'm in now, there were really two people, Howard Schatz and Rich McDonald, who were real inspirations as to be somebody that could be working in private practice, yet doing good academic work, being somebody that could be a good teacher, and that was a real inspiration to me. And then on top of that, the other faculty at UCSF at the time were wonderful. There was Dan Schwartz and Marco Zarbin, who both are real brilliant minds and great people, and I was inspired to be more like them.
So you finished your residency at UCSF, and then where did you head for fellowship?
So I went to Duke for fellowship, and again, you know, really incredible people that I got to work with and be around, and were not only great surgeons, great clinicians, but also really just fun and wonderful people to be around, and that included, you know, Brooks McEwen, Robert Mockamer, Cindy Toth, Glenn Jaffe, just an incredible cast of people there.
So, and now you're in practice at West Coast Retina, which you referenced that this model of being in private practice yet still being academically involved, whether it's in training fellows, and your group does have a fellowship, or being involved in the community, as you and many of the members of your group are, in terms of presenting research, but clinical research as well as new techniques. And one of the things we're going to talk about is a technique you discussed at several meetings, which is the idea of doing external needle drainage during retinal detachment repair, but during vitrectomy. When did this idea come to fruition, and how did you first implement it when it started?
Well, you know, I must say, I guess I was really inspired by my training. When I was at Duke University, we had just started to use external drainage with a needle during scleral buckling surgery, and it was a bit of a something that Glenn Jaffe wrote a paper on while we were there. He was really motivated from a scientific standpoint to obtain these pure subretinal fluid specimens during buckling surgery, but it made a lot of sense to me. I remember that period when we were doing these scleral cutdowns and choroidal punctures to drain subretinal fluid, where you're not really looking inside the eye, and the eye gets real soft, and you're kind of wondering what's going to happen. And when I saw that we were doing this external drainage with the needle and I was learning that technique, I really dedicated myself to it because I thought that during scleral buckling it was much more controlled. And so that's something I embraced and really have learned well and trained my fellows to do so as well. But then I have been inspired also. I spent a very short period of time, but a very valuable period of time with Mike Tracy, who I've saw a lot of pediatric retinal surgery, and he did things and with very severe detachments in kids that involved external drainage at times to obtain space so that he could do vitrectomy later. And I think that those sorts of things were what inspired me to try this during vitrectomy. And it just turns out that my practice is such that I do get some tough cases referred to me. And I remember the first case I tried this on was not anything that I've reported on because I didn't think to do it or record it at the time, but it was a bad serous detachment in somebody that had been seen for a long period of time, wasn't really sure what to do, treated with all kinds of steroids and such because of the what they thought was the inflammatory nature of the detachment, which I think was true. But eventually, wanted to try to get the retina reattached and thought, I'm going to put a buckle on this eye, I'm going to put infusion in, and then try to drain as best I can externally to get a fluid sample to rule out malignancy and infection, and then do a vitrectomy. The eye was very soft, put oil in, and that eye remained attached, and the vision got somewhat better, and that inspired me to keep trying it.
So let's talk about how you do this from a technique perspective. You referenced that when you do buckles, you prefer to do an external needle drainage. Do you do that under direct visualization during your primary buckles?
I do. And I have done a few times through the microscope with putting a chandelier light in, but most of the time I'm using just a 25-gauge needle with an indirect on my head and going to the area of highest detachment, hopefully furthest away from the macula, so that if it's a bullous detachment and I can drain inferonasally, that's probably my favorite place to drain. But I'll drain anywhere and try my best to get as much fluid out from underneath the retina with the indirect.
And then for a vitrectomy, we'll talk about the pros and cons and scenarios where this might be more useful. But this is one of those things I've seen videos of, and a lot of times you see a video and you see someone like you doing it, and it looks so easy. But I've tried it. There's definitely a learning curve to kind of positioning your hand and everything correctly while under the biome or Resite or Avi, whatever indirect viewing system you're using, or contact lens. So how do you set this up? Do you normally put a sleeve on the needle before you go in? Take us through kind of the nuts and bolts of what you do to set this up for yourself.
Yeah, so what I do is when I have one of these really tough cases, and by the way, I don't do this that often, and I was just on a sort of a panel discussion on Retina Times, which I think is coming out right now, about the same topic, in which Jason Chu reports on, discusses how he's kind of taken this a little bit as well, and he reports using one of those guarded needles in which he has a needle that has a sleeve on it, essentially a scleral buckling sleeve that he puts around the needle, which can then be used to somewhat guard the needle from going too far in. I tend to use just a 25-gauge, 5/8-inch needle. After I put the buckle on and I've sort of snugged the buckle down, I've put in infusion and a chandelier light in the eye. I then get the infusion pressure really high, 60 to 80 momentarily. I then sort of snake the kind of outside of the scope. I get the needle in the bed of the buckle with the bevel away from the globe, and I then put the Resite in, and as I'm looking at my indentation, oftentimes you can just see your indentation before you enter the eye. I know where the most bullous part of the detachment is, and I then gently move the needle into the subretinal space or the intraschisis space, depending on what kind of situation I have, and watch that fluid go away. When this happens, even when you're doing a buccal drainage without infusion in the eye, usually the bullous part of the detachment really races towards the the needle, meaning that you get more fluid rush to that part and the retina becomes a bit more bullous where the needle has entered the eye, and then it starts fluttering until eventually the retina kind of drapes over the needle, and that's when it's time to withdraw the needle.
And so you're doing this before removing the vitreous or once you've already finished your vitrectomy?
Absolutely, yeah. So that's one of the important parts is that we're doing this sort of almost first thing. So I'll put on a buckle, and reminder that, you know, these are really cases that sometimes we have no idea what's going on. We just know that the retina is detached to the back of the lens, sometimes the back of the IOL or the back of the phakic lens, and we don't know if there's a break. Sometimes it's hard to see that. And so putting a buckle on in those situations makes sense every time to me, even if I determine that in the end it was a serous detachment. Because a lot of times in a totally detached eye, the vitreous is abnormal anyway. There's contraction of it, and it may not conform to the back wall of the eye even after you've reattached the retina. So putting a buckle on makes just sense to me. And then in those cases, if it's a serous detachment and I've actually done the needle drainage and I happen to have the complication of penetrating the retina with the needle, which can happen, usually that happens in the bed of the buckle, and so it's supported by the buckle. And so, you know, that's important to know. And so this is done before the vitrectomy, and there have been times when I've now been able to, after the retina is reattached, do a very aggressive hyaloid removal because the retina is not bullous, and I've been able to do, you know, maneuvers that are much easier done in an attached or partially attached retina than a totally detached retina.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned serous detachments as a scenario where this can be helpful. You've described this, but I've thought, you know, especially when you have a chronic kind of quadrantic detachment that for whatever reason you need to do a vitrectomy as well. Maybe it would have been amenable to a primary buckle, but there's another reason for a vitrectomy. But you have a sense that the detachment's chronic. I think it would be nice to do an external drainage as well. There's been some discussion that, you know, some people believe the chronic fluid may be predisposed to PVR. If you expose to the vitreous cavity, that there's something about that milieu that is not optimal. And I guess the more that you could kind of remove from an external approach and not expose it to the vitreous, and maybe not have to make a drainage retinotomy, for example, or use perfluoron, would be nice.
Yes. You know, if it's a chronic regmatogenous detachment, the times that I have used this are when, let's say, there's a need for a vitrectomy, and I see preoperatively or intraoperatively that the pars plane is detached. In an area, or the retina is very bullous in an area, and I'm worried about putting in a trocar cannula in that area that I'm going to make more of a mess with the retina than it already is. So in those cases, I might put in a cannula away from that side and a chandelier and infusion, and then either drain externally, which you can do, but keep in mind, whenever you're draining in a regmatogenous situation, you're not going to get as much fluid as you will in one of these serous detachments or a retinaschisis type situation. And so even though you'll get the majority of the fluid out, or a lot of that subretinal fluid out with the needle drainage, you're probably going to end up needing to do more maneuvers to get all the fluid out from underneath the retina. And that might mean draining through the original break. That has not worked out for me every time, but that can work. But, you know, I think sometimes you've got that pars plana detached and you maybe even don't need to do any kind of trocar cannula on that side if you've got a chandelier light in and you can depress and shave. But what I'll also do sometimes is just not put a trocar cannula on that side that has the bullous detachment. Use the cutter to remove subretinal fluid from the inside of the eye through the break. Relieve traction on the break and drain, maybe even without ever putting a cannula on that side, which can work. So, you know, that's an option as well. Jason Sue mentioned this as well, and, you know, and that he's been doing this more and more in more conventional detachments, and I think it makes good sense, although I think getting more complete drainage is not as easy when you're doing it where there's a pre-existing break and more fluid can go through that.
So this is kind of a side note to this conversation, but I think I took it for granted when I was a fellow that, you know, attendings would be trying a newer technique or introducing something different into their surgical armamentarium. But now that I'm attending, I appreciate it's difficult, right? Because whether you're in academic or private practice, there's a push for efficiency. You obviously want the best possible outcome for every patient. And then if you're in an environment where you're training as well, how do you keep current? I mean, you're someone who's kind of, in terms of trying different things or going to a meeting and seeing something new, or even an idea that you think about that you want to implement, how do you balance that? There's four parts. You have the efficiency, the patient care, the teaching, and then the fourth part is you want to keep advancing and improving and like pushing your limits a little bit as a surgeon. How do you personally do that or decide when to incorporate something new?
Well, I got to say, you know, there's a lot of inspiration when you are training fellows. I feel like, you know, we use a term around our practice of, and this is a bad thing to say about somebody, but they've gotten off the elevator. It means that, you know, at some point beyond their training, they just sort of stopped wanting to try new things. They stopped wanting to learn. They stopped really paying attention at meetings. And they're kind of stuck at whatever year that they stopped doing those things. And I never wanted to get off the elevator. Having a fellow around makes you to where you just can't, because they're good fellows that we have that we are training kind of keep pushing you and saying, well, you know, so-and-so's trying this, and I saw this at a meeting. And so you're very motivated. And our fellows have a lot of opportunities in their training to do their own cases, and so they're always inspired to try things that others have taught them in our practice, and so they're sort of like incubators of all the different techniques that they've learned from all of us and teaching each of us what our other partners are doing or what they've learned at a meeting. And so I think that the fellowship is the most important part to me in kind of keeping going. But I really take a lot of inspiration from meetings. I particularly like case conferences. And so I go to three or four different case conferences a year. And a lot of times I'm talking to others about some technique that they're trying, and people will show their technique like I did at the veil vitrectomy meeting originally. And I feel that that's a really great way for me to try new things. And I feel that, you know, when something makes sense to me at a presentation, that it's going to be something that makes things either more efficient or allow me to do something that I've never been able to do well before, like, you know, say needle drainage in these tough cases, I really will try to implement that pretty quickly. And most of these things don't take a lot of extra time in the OR, but they do take a lot of time beforehand. If I have a new technique that I want to try, I'm going to basically sit with that night before and write out every step on a piece of paper. And I'll tape that to the microscope, you know, somewhere so that I can take a look at it. And it'll be like I'm doing something the first time. And to me, I think that's a very important part of it, is basically preparation, because I don't feel like I'll be spending a whole lot more time. In fact, I feel like I spent a lot less time on these early cases when I was doing this needle drainage, because I was able to get out the subretinal fluid without creating a bunch of new breaks and things like that. But you do have to think it through before the surgery begins, for sure.
You know, you referenced staffing fellows, and this is something that we talk about a lot on this program, but it's especially on my mind because I'm giving a talk about this next week. So I'm kind of like thinking about the things, and staffing fellows, I think, is, it's obviously very beneficial, but it's also, again, you take it for granted when you're a fellow. And then you become an attending, and the roles swap, and you realize how difficult and tricky it can be to explain things, and how rewarding it can be at times. And then, you know, it's kind of this pendulum that swings back and forth in terms of, you know, evaluating yourself as a teacher. How good are you explaining things before surgery, during surgery, after surgery? And fellows do keep you honest and keep you up to date. What are kind of the biggest things or challenges or things you've learned just from staffing fellows in the operating room? If you had words of wisdom for me or other younger attendings who are in the same position, what would you tell them about staffing fellows?
Yeah, you know, I'm so humbled by the incredible training that I received and the patience that the people had with me. I feel like, to me, the biggest thing, that if I have time, I'm a much better teacher than when I'm under stress and duress time-wise. So that means that, you really, I feel like, as best you can, try to make their teaching moments happen at times when you don't have to be at a clinic in 30 minutes. I feel that, to me, I am the guy in our practice that is very dogmatic. I have things that I want them to do the same exact way every time. And when they first come on to my service and they're a brand new fellow, I say, okay, you're going to watch this case and you're going to go take notes afterward, and I'm going to tell you every step of the way. And then I want you, the next time you come in, to have a few of those steps remembered, so that by the third or fourth case that you and I are doing together, you've got them all figured out. Mm-hmm. And when you get them all figured out, that's how we're going to do it from now on. Now, see, that's the dogma of, you know, kind of the kind of repeat stuff. Well, then, you know, we're going to add a new technique that the fellow and I have never done before, and we'll go from there. But at least we have this foundation of steps so that things aren't missed. We always look for the position of the cannula before we turn on the infusion, things like that. And we always put the buckle on the exact same way, so that I feel like when it's a really tough case, when there's duress, when it's late at night, you've got those things really set so that you're not kind of thinking about the easy stuff and you're able to concentrate on the more complex parts of the problem. So that, to me, is one, is just having the fellows write down their steps so that they know the next time around how you like it, and they're going to be able to start operating much more quickly with me that way. I've become much more patient with the fellows here over time, and I think that just takes time, and you have to really kind of work with yourself and decide how willing you are to have the fellows do new maneuvers with you and everything. I feel that there's also steps that, you know, I think are very important. For instance, as far as membrane peeling or ILM peeling, I'm a kind of pinch and peel person, mm-hmm. but I don't think that that's the easiest thing to train somebody with initially. Right. And so I will either start it for them or more recently start using a loop kind of peeling technique with the, you know, more new devices for peeling, so that the fellows can then get things started, make things easier for them. I'll sometimes, if somebody's much dominant on one hand or the other and they're just starting, I'll start the PRP. I'll give a box of laser for them to fill in, mm-hmm. so that they get some success very early on. But our fellows, we try to get them operating from day one, and then kind of as their level goes, so goes their amount of time under the scope. And I hope that I feel like I'm doing my fellows right by the amount of time that they're getting in the cases that they're doing. But it is always a challenge for the teacher, and you really do appreciate your mentors much more after you start teaching, because it really is a stressful thing. I really think that if I had all the money in the world, that all of our ORs would have the 3D viewing systems so that I could use some sort of a pointer and point to exactly what I mean. That's an issue that I have, where I'm asking them to peel something or delaminate something in a certain place, and it's hard for me to point that out exactly. And so having one of those heads-up display systems would be pretty neat to use for that purpose.
Yeah, I think that it's so funny you brought that up, because even yesterday I was doing a tractional detachment repair, and again, it was close enough to that boundary. I remember being a fellow, and the attending's like, oh, grab that point right here between these vessels, and you just don't know where exactly what they're seeing, and then you switch, and you have the experience. You know exactly where the plane is. You know exactly where to initiate, but pointing it out exactly where to go can be very difficult from a side scope. So you're right. I haven't had the opportunity to use the heads up, except in a demo fashion, but that is a benefit that could be nice in terms of teaching.
Yes, it would. Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Jumper, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for waking up early in the West Coast and joining us. And I look forward to seeing you in person at one of our upcoming meetings.
Thank you, Jay. I appreciate what you're doing with this. It's really great, and good luck with you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's retinapodcast.com. All 101 episodes can be found there, sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Round Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. And on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. And the positive reviews you continue to leave in the Apple Podcast Store as well as Google Play will continue to help us as well. Many thanks to Dr. Michael Jumper for joining me. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Benacosta, and Angela Chang for producing this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you continue to inspire here. This is Jay Schrader, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.